Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 105, recorded February 3rd, 2011. Sandy Bridge is falling.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by MailRoute. Businesses of every size use MailRoute. One user, 50,000 users, it doesn't matter. MailRoute will protect you from spam and viruses, simplify your life, and make your email usable again. Visit MailRoute.info for more details.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by the amazing benchmarking madman and apparently sufferer of SATA card woes? No, wait.
Raid card woes.
Yeah.
So all of our readers and listeners out there, viewers and readers, wow, I got them wrong again. Everybody who's paying attention, you think the hardware madness only happens to you. That's definitely not the case. We've spent the last couple of days here pulling our hair out trying to diagnose hardware problems, fixing bootable devices or, you know, did you know if you take out some hard drives that you thought were just, you know, you hadn't used them in like 6-8 months, if they had the master boot record on it, it basically screws up the whole system. And then you have to like put the SATA cables back in the right order so that the array works again on that ICH-based things, so that you can actually boot up and actually activate a drive. And yeah,
that's one of the reasons I have a Drobo, because I don't have to pay attention to what order the drives go back in.
yeah, that would be beneficial to have in the future, no doubt.
Oh my goodness. Big story this week, obviously. Intel having a little trouble with Sandy Bridge. To sort of slow down on the fear, uncertainty, and doubt, because I got some emails from some severely panicked people. Sandy Bridge chipset, 3 GB SATA ports, only on the quad-core Sandy Bridge chips. Essentially, they expect over time there to be problems with the 3 GB SATA ports. The 6 GB SATA ports are unaffected. Short answer is, you know, big giant Intel recall. They're calling something like $300 million in chargebacks, $700 million in repairs, basically swapping out motherboards and notebooks and desktops. Right. How are you feeling about this so far, Ryan? I mean, your Sandy Bridge system, if you already own it, should run fine, and Intel is going to foot the bill to replace it.
Yeah. If you have a Sandy Bridge system today, I've also had a lot of emails, and a lot of people in the forums are asking, you know, what do we do? What do we do? If you know, the chances of you seeing this problem are pretty slim, especially in the time between now and the end of March, beginning of April, when they'll have replacements ready. Just continue to use the system. If you're actually that worried about it, you can just move the hard drives that might be attached to the SATA 3.0 gigabit per second connections to the SATA 6.0 gigabit per second connections, and you shouldn't have a problem there. I think it's important to note that you said it doesn't happen. It's not going to happen on the dual core processors when that comes out. It's really not a processor related item. It's the chipset itself. It's just that the dual core chips aren't out yet. So when those are released, they won't have this chipset running under them. They'll have the next revision of this chipset running under them. It affects desktop and mobile. It's kind of a big deal. That, you know, and Intel has said over and over again in their press releases that they're fortunate that this happened so early in the product's launch, because there's not a huge market of individuals that have these sitting in their systems. That's also kind of a nice way of saying we didn't sell as many as we thought, maybe as we thought we would in the first month of production. So you can look at it both ways.
But I don't know. My thought on that was like, I think they were more saying like diffusing the, because a lot of what they do in the financial reports is diffusing Wall Street panic, or for that matter, when they do a big announcement Monday morning out of nowhere, Intel's like, we're recalling Sandy Bridge. And I think their spin on that was to take advantage of, you know, Intel. We've been making money hand over fist, and hey, Wall Street analysts, before you ding us really heavily on this, look, you know, if we discovered this 6 months from now, we'd be writing off, you know, $2 or $3 billion instead of like $1 billion, or they $4 or $5 billion.
Right.
I thought it was interesting because, you know, you and I were talking about this on Techzilla when you were kind enough to guest on Monday, and I've heard it from two or three other people in the last few days, is literally this came out of nowhere. You know, one of Intel's partners doing long-term, basically abusive testing, heat testing of motherboards, the chip fails, they call up Intel, Intel verifies it, and literally over the weekend, 9 a.m. Monday morning, bang, this announcement comes out. So, you know, Intel was pretty hot and heavy about not hiding this or keeping it under their hat.
I still kind of... There's some editorials out and about, and I kind of agree with one segment of them. Intel says now that this could affect if they let the chipsets continue to filter out 5 to 15% of consumers over a 3-year period.
Wow,
that's a huge number, and it kind of makes me wonder how this got through Intel's quality controls at all. You know, 1% is a huge deal, but 5 to 15%, you would have thought that Intel would have been testing these chipsets in the same type of situations, if not worse situations, than their end consumers, their customers, you know, the system builders and notebook vendors would be doing. And obviously, that did not come to surface. So,
is it an issue with the
changes some things inside?
Is it an issue, a physical issue with the mounting of the chip, or is it an issue with the chip series themselves? I mean, could they have been using a previous run of chips and the new run of chips fail, or?
It's in the silicon of the chip itself. So anything, you know, that would have been tested, scrutinized, would have had this same issue. It's a silicon level problem. It's not, you know, implementation. It's not, you know, anything that maybe were, you know, it's not an external chip, maybe, or not a resistor or something like that has to accompany this chip. It's in the silicon itself. The new six or the new fix requires the respin of the chip itself. So it's still kind of confusing how this got out, and the fact that Intel's OEMs found it for them. You know, that's not that abnormal, but you would think it would be a much more rare problem than a, quote, 5 to 15% likelihood of seeing this.
Well, let's take a look at a question real quick from Mickey, who basically says, what can I buy now? He has a friend who's about to click the buy button on a Sandy Bridge system they were going to build on Sunday night. We all know what happened Monday morning. My question is, now what? Do we look at AMD, the older Intel stuff? Do we wait? His friend is without a system at the moment. Thanks, says Mickey.
It's tough because there's a lot of people worried about this. If you look at even like NVIDIA and AMD's graphics departments, I've been talking to them. They're worried that nobody's going to buy anything for the next 2 months.
Right.
It's going to stall the channel. I think what consumers, you know, have the option of doing, you know, there's 1156, you know, the Linfield platform is still a viable option. But we know that 1156 or the new Sandy Bridge parts, the new Sandy Bridge socket is going to come out. They're not compatible. So if you buy a system based on that, you don't have a very good upgrade path. And the same thing is probably said of the LGA 1366 platform, that there are lots of rumors swirling around about the 2011 socket that Intel's coming out with that will replace that on the high end for server workstation, super high end desktop. So there's, you know, the Intel roadmap kind of looks very stalled until they get these new 6 series chipsets out and about. The AMD platform looks a little bit better. We know that Bulldozer is coming out. That's their next generation architecture. Those will be backwards compatible with the latest AMD processor sockets that you can buy today. So you have that option going forward. I'm thinking that we'll see kind of an uptick in AMD sales with this. You know, the AMD 6-core processors, I think, on Wednesday or Tuesday earlier this week, they actually had a big price drop. You know, I think AMD's maybe trying to take advantage of the fact that if you go to Newegg or Zipsumfly or Tiger Direct, you can't buy a lot of Intel processors. All the Sandy Bridge processors are taken off the market.
Right.
Somebody's got to buy something.
Yeah, I'm really curious. Like, not that we're a financial podcast, but I'm
right.
I thought the 300, yeah, or maybe it was you who got me thinking about this. The $300 million estimate in lost sales seems astronomically low for Intel. But yeah, this is a great opportunity for, you know, the crew over at AMD. If your friend is desperate for a system, I wouldn't have a problem. You know, especially if you were looking at an i3 or an i5, you know, AMD's definitely hanging there. I think, you know, a little lower performance on the CPU, but the multiple multiple cores can be really nice depending on the applications you're running. There's a really good article actually up on PC Perspective also that I think a lot of our readers would be interested in, which is the how do you deal with a broken Sandy Bridge? for all of the early adopters who are staring at their computer like, really? Really, Intel? The floating point issue wasn't enough?
Very true. And that this is basically kind of we're getting a lot of reports, and actually there's even more updated press releases and information from manufacturers like ECS, Tech Report, or ECS, Gigabyte, Asus, all the major guys on how they're going to deal with it. Nobody has anything super specific yet. It's mostly assurances to their customers. Yes, we are going to replace your board. Yes, we're going to foot the cost. I think MSI already has a site up where you can go register your product, you know, give them a serial number, your address, all that type of thing, and they will get back to you when they have. Because, I mean, the truth is they're not exactly sure when they're going to get replacements. It's going to be end of March, beginning of April time period, and they need to know how many users are going to get replacements and how quickly they can get to them and, you know, exactly what product they're going to go. Because I expect these motherboard guys to not just – some of them will probably just slap on a new chipset on the existing design and go. Chances are if they've got 2 months of time to just sit there, their engineers might be, I don't know, tweaking things, making things a little bit better, lowering costs, something to that effect. So the product stack will probably change a little by the time we get to early April as well.
It's got to be just if you didn't send in your registration card, it's probably time to now. It's going to be interesting because this is also an RMA nightmare. If anybody's ever worked in sort of receiving, can you imagine X percent, which on any viable product is single digit, you know, your failure rate has got to be 2-3%, 5% of products, probably a 5% return rate. You're starting to look at a really ugly situation for a lot of products, and now they're looking at a 100% return rate for all the leading edge projects for products from the company. And that's got to be you can smell FedEx, preparing to do extra drop offs and hiring temporary people to help handle the flow. And, you know, IT guys nervously looking at the entire system they have to monitor and track RMAs because they have to make sure the product comes in, the parts are all there, the new box goes out. It's going to be an expensive bill to foot for Intel.
I'm curious to see how it's going to work. If some of these motherboard manufacturers might be, this is a good opportunity for them to kind of showcase their customer service above and beyond just replacing it. Are they going to be willing to drop ship you your motherboard, send you the new motherboard, and then have you send the old one back, as opposed to sending your motherboard out to your system? If it's your only computer, RMA and your motherboard basically gives you no computer. So I would be pushing for drop shipping. Give me my new product, and then I'll send you the old one back. You know, credit card holds, all that kind of deal. But there's an opportunity here for these motherboard companies to come out looking like the good guys, leaving Intel footing the bill and looking like the bad guys.
And we should also point out this isn't just motherboard companies. This is Dell, HP, this is the biggest system manufacturers in the world who are now sitting there going like,
that's expensive to ship.
Systems are expensive to ship, and also people, they migrate to the new machine. Like corporations, they migrate to a new machine. All their data is on there. Are they going to, I don't think anybody can afford to send a technician to basically go to everybody's house and help them migrate to the new machine. A mess. Crisis. I like this title. Crisis 2 looks like it isn't that hard on your PC specs after all. Crisis, of course, being the video game that no one really liked except for testing graphics and CPUs on systems. I mean, I don't know anybody who's ever played it for fun, but everybody I know who tests graphics cards or who is a GPU geek, a graphics card geek, is like, what's performance like on Crisis? Oh, 8 frames per day. Yeah, that's
kind of like the forum tagline. Is anytime a graphics card was released, does it play Crisis? And you're right. I think Crisis Warhead was a much better game than Crisis, although it wasn't super awful, but graphically it was impressive at the time. But damn, did it hit your hardware, right? I mean, I did like a little kind of summation. It was kind of interesting to go back and look. I published a performance preview of the original Crysis when it came out in November of 2007. And the graphics card.
How about
card,
that anti-aliasing number?
Yeah, I know. 8800 GTX. We're getting like 12 frames a second at 16 by 12 with 4X AA on. And that, I think, was like the best card you could get at the time. And it never really got much better than that.
No, I mean, that throughout. Was like a $300 to $500, probably a $500 card when it came out originally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was expensive, but now the minimum system requirements of Crysis 2 are finally out, and we know the history of that is, you know, they basically came out and said we had a lot of fun making Crysis and Crysis Warhead. Sales weren't that great. We need to make money on this, so we're going to co-develop it for PC and console. And because of that, we're going to get what PC enthusiasts will say is a less impressive game and what gamers in general will say is just easier to play on your PC. Minimum requirements, Core 2 Duo or an Athlon 64 X2 processor at 2 gigahertz, which is pretty basic. 2 gigs of RAM and an NVIDIA 8800 GT with 512 megs of memory or an ATI 3850. So those hardware specs are... they're about 3.5 years old. So the 8800 GT has been out for about 3.5 years. So that's pretty much, I think, going to cover almost anybody that's going to want to play Crysis 2 on the PC, which is better than what we had with the release of the first game. So,
do you think Crysis is effective? Oops, sorry.
I was going to say it's bad news for NVIDIA and ATI and their graphics departments.
I don't know. There's so many other games that I enjoy so much more than Crysis. And also, just looking at Crysis, like, I think the brand is broken. Like, they did this amazing, ridiculous, over-the-top thing. And, you know, it was awesome for stressing games to see what the performance is like. But it was absolutely unplayable for most people. And then by the time their systems caught up, they didn't really enjoy playing it when they got there. I hate to harsh on the Crysis team, but, you know, it may be time to just sort of draw a line in the sand and come up with a new name and a new game. Should we talk about IPv6, IPv4?
Okay, yeah, you're saying that they, given away all the addresses, when does our internet stop working now?
Yeah, well, ICANN basically, they distributed the last batch of remaining IP addresses, IPv4 addresses, to the regional internet registries, which means there are now officially all 4 billion something IPv4 IP addresses have been assigned, which means they're going to basically, it's time for IPv6 to start rolling out in a serious way. You know, which basically IPv6 addresses, you know, sort of dotted quad, you end up with a 128-bit address. I won't start trying to spout them out because I'll just start laughing too hard. But I like the idea that there's a planned World IPv6 Day scheduled for June 8, 2011. And the idea is that, you know, Google and every other giant company that works on the internet is going to implement, quote, as many IPv6 services or as many services as possible on IPv6. So I sense in the next few weeks we're going to start getting that flood of like, how do I make my router run with IPv6 or am I doomed?
Yeah. They handed them all out, but that doesn't mean that there are no more left. It just means all the ones that are in existence now belong to the ISPs or whatever to be handed out to their customers. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, basically, nobody's going to run out of IP addresses for a while, but, you know, for everything that the government's bought, I want to say since 2007, 2008 has been required to be IPv6 compatible. Chances are, you know, you can run IPv4 and IPv6 in parallel on the same network. It's going to be really interesting. You know, it's going to be really interesting to watch this migration and how it impacts consumers or if it impacts consumers very much at all.
I'm not looking forward to having to remember IPv6 addresses looking at them.
I don't think anybody's I take that back. I know people who like live in DNS and basically run like the giant DNS servers, and they can probably rip off a 128-bit address, but they also think in machine code, and you know their idea of Sudoku is they want a Sudoku that's like 300 boxes by 300 boxes.
I didn't know IPv6 is in hexadecimal notation, not just about a decimal notation. So that's going to complicate things for me, I believe. Yeah. Yeah. But it looks like how many IP addresses is that? 2 to the 128. That should be that should be good for a while.
It's a number that is so large that I don't actually know. You know, it's, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 24, 27, 30, 33, 36, 39 digits.
Okay.
38 digits. A lot. I told it was something like 1,000. You know, or 100,000 IP addresses for every square inch on the planet or something ridiculous like that. It's a you know, considering there's basically, you know, there's 4,294,967,296 IPv4 addresses, and now there's, you know, a lot more than that to use a you know, to use a, it's going to be interesting, because one of the reasons they decided to go with such a ridiculously large number is, A, when they came up with the IPv4 system in 1981, no one anticipated every home in America,
sure,
you know, having internet as a fundamental need, right? Nobody envisioned the World Wide Web exploding the way it did. They certainly didn't envision the idea that there's going to be devices in your home that need their own IP address. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that's wrapped around the internet, IPv6, is the idea of the Internet of Things, where, you know, strange devices, or, you know, maybe, you know, every single container in the world that's used for shipping has its own IP address. And it sort of enables a large scale tracking of everything on the planet, or you assign an IP address to every element inside a brand new 5,000 room casino, so that all of the bizarre little wireless networks, you know, Zigbee, you know, the idea that you'll have a sort of a self creating mesh network inside of a large building, so that all of the power and all of the switching and all of the control and all of the thermals are accessible and have their own individual IP address. It's going to be fun to watch. Or completely insane and maddening as an end user.
Or, yeah, in no way will you be able to understand what's going on, probably. But before we jump into our emails, take a quick second here to thank today's podcast sponsor. That would be MailRoute. Businesses of every size use MailRoute. One user, 50,000 users, it doesn't matter. They can protect you from spam, viruses, simplify your life, and make your email usable again. Now, MailRoute is it's a secure hosted service that filters virus and spam for companies of any size. Single user, 1,000 employees, that doesn't matter. It eliminates viruses and spam, reduces the load on your own email servers, so you may be able to use less servers, possibly lower your costs, make your email usable again. Typical MailRoute customers see 95% reduction in their inbound email volume with virtually no false positives. Now, Leo, who is on vacation but still apparently runs this network, loves MailRoute. He's been using the service for his domains for more than 6 years and virus filtering all along. Tom Merritt started using MailRoute, and now he can use email domains that he'd given up on being able to use as hopeless. Tom Johnson, the founder and CEO of MailRoute, started one of the very first companies in this market back in 1998. Probably had no IPv6 issues there. FrontBridge was acquired by Microsoft in 2005, but Tom still had a lot of ideas for this service. So rather than let them go to waste, he started MailRoute, the next generation service for filtering email. Nothing easier than mail filtering with MailRoute either. No hardware or software you have to install locally. You just sign up for MailRoute and then change your MX records on your domain to start your mail flowing through them. And then it sends the mail back to your local servers. They do all the work for you. Visit MailRoute.info to sign up. As a Twit listener, you'll receive a 10% discount for the life of your account. Small business accounts start at $2 per month for 10 users. And because of demand from the Twit Army, MailRoute has added a new service for individual users as well. Less than $30 per user per year for single users. Visit MailRoute.info and sign up with the email filtering service that Tom and Leo use. And we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Thanks, MailRoute.
Indeed.
Email, Martin, Quebec, not Canada, he says. Having dated a woman from Quebec, I can understand where Martin's coming from, and we won't discuss such desperate linguistic and political issues on the show. He says, I've just purchased and installed a 128-gigabyte Kingston SSD Now V100 in my 3-year-old Core 2 Duo laptop. Wow, it feels incredibly faster. This is one of the best $179 I've spent in a long time. The upgrade kit comes with an external enclosure, USB cable, and CD-ROM with a Acronis TrueImage. You just have to replace the internal drive with the SSD, place the old drive in the external enclosure, and boot from the CD. An hour later, you can boot from the SSD. I know the Kingston SSD is not the best compared to Intel or SandForce-based drives, but the sale price and upgrade kit that worked exactly as advertised made it a good choice in my opinion. And now I have a free 160-gigabyte compact external drive. Remember when 160-gigabyte drive seemed so big? Now my question. I just picked up a 1 terabyte Western Digital 2.5-inch external drive for like $100 from Costco last week. Yeah, that pretty much sums it up.
Good deal.
Now we get to Martin's question. I was and am still running Windows Vista Home. I cannot reinstall Windows, or better yet, install Windows 7 from scratch as recommended, because I have software that cannot be reinstalled that I must keep. What optimizations and how should I perform? Basically, how do I tweak Vista? Vista does not have native trim support. Is there a way to retrofit trim support onto Vista? If trim is impossible, how do I, quote, reinitialize, unquote, the drive to restore performance that I will lose over time, and how often? Any other info? This laptop is not my main machine. I have a proper desktop, a Core i7-980X with a 5870 at home, and I am waiting for a SATA 6-gig SSD for it. Yes, you will like the 60-gigabyte SATA SSD in the Core i7 machine. Ask me how I know. But yeah, Vista does not have trim. How worried should people be? You know, for that matter, neither does OS X. How worried should people be running, you know, Vista in non-trim augmented
system? It's not as big a deal as it used to be. The first round of drives, the firmware on them were really poor, did not recover at all, were known to fall to very, very degraded levels of performance after some use. That's not really the case now. No, there is no way to retrofit trim support onto Windows Vista in any way. The way that our storage guru, Alan, kind of reinitializes his drive is that there's an application called HDTAC, and it's actually a benchmark application. And there's a mode on that application where you can do like a short test, a long test, or a full test. And the full test actually reads data from the beginning of the drive to the end of the drive. And you can do that on your active drive. And what it does is it basically will write zeros to all the empty spaces and try to read the data the whole way through. Now, with that, it might not restore it all the way, but it will restore a lot of the performance of the drive. And I don't know how frequently you need to do it. I wouldn't do it unless you start to notice some kind of performance difference. You know, I would say once a month would be more than you would, you know, need to do it. Maybe every couple or 3 months would really be, you know, something to keep in mind. If you're just kind of like that performance nut that just wants to make sure you're not missing anything, even if you don't notice it, right? You know, if you're the guy that cares about that 5 frames, because you paid for it, even though you might not notice it, then you might want to do that.
Schedule it for 3 a.m. on Saturday night every week.
Yeah, yeah.
That would probably be overkill. That's a really cool hack, though, from Alan.
Yeah. It's not something you need to run all the time, but it's a way that we use to refresh hard drives after we've done a lot of testing on them. You know, when we kind of get them to like as close to straight from the factory state, that's what they'll do on it. So. We got an email from Chuck in Ann Arbor, wants to know, or he says he's slowly transcoding all of his DVDs to MP4s for his Apple TV. His current setup is a Core 2 Quad Q9400, 8 gigs of RAM, and a 9800 GT. Software is primarily Bada Boom, which is one of the kind of NVIDIA-sponsored GPU-accelerated transcoding apps. Occasionally Handbrake he uses for episodic shows. He's happy enough with the quality, but he's always looking for improvements. I like that Bada Boom uses hardly any CPU cycles, using the GPU instead. The current Bada Boom is unable to use Fermi NVIDIA cards. Apparently, version 2.0 will. What would the biggest bang for my buck be if I wanted faster transcoding?
Well, it depends on how obsessed he is with only using the GPU for transcoding. And, of course, Sandy Bridge is out of the picture, so... you know, are we waiting for Bada Boom 2.0? I mean,
I would say that's probably the best case. Even, you know, Sandy Bridge is definitely going to be faster than his Core 2 Quad in terms of transcoding performance. Right. There's been a lot of, you've got hyperthreading involved, plus you've got just core enhancements that will improve performance there. If he's happy with the quality that he's getting from Bada Boom doing GPU encoding or transcoding, then I would think moving from a 9800 GT, which is a fairly old graphics card, moving to like a 560 or a 570 from NVIDIA, the more shader processors you have on your GPU, the faster that's going to be. So, you know, go towards the 570 if you can afford it, type of deal. And yeah, Bada Boom 2.0, I don't have any idea really when that's going to come out. I haven't talk with those guys in a while.
They were saying February. On the website, you can sign up now to sort of try to be part of the beta or the initial delivery on that one.
Okay.
Whether or not they'll actually deliver it in February is obviously an entirely different question.
Now, what's interesting here, I just went to their site and I saw that little post. They also mention hardware accelerated support for NVIDIA Fermi GPUs and Sandy Bridge hardware, which says to me that their app is going to use that transcoding, dedicated transcoding hardware in the Sandy Bridge processor, which could be really cool. Might even be faster than the GPU. So I'd say you're probably going to want a new graphics card eventually anyway. So go ahead and get a 560. Use that until Refresh Sandy Bridge comes out and you want to spend more money for that, would be my guess.
Yeah, I'm wondering also if RipBot is working. That's kind of a under the radar. Gosh,
working with the GPUs or...
Yeah, I don't know. It's been a while. So I don't think RipBot's been upgraded in a while. But it's also nice that the encoding quality on Bada Boom got picked up really fast after the 1.0 version.
Looks like there's an update to RipBot on January 26th of 2011. I don't know what it added, but it did have an update. So, that, you know, something else to try out, you know, if you want to try out the free open source options as well. While you're just kind of hanging out waiting for whatever hardware you're going to purchase, that's never a bad idea.
Gosh, I haven't played around with either one of those in a long time. Something to do this weekend. In the meantime, Joel has a question about 8X PCI Express graphics cards. He's got a Dell PowerEdge SC1420, which is an unusual system for a home user. The issue has, it's got... let's see, PCI Express, 8-bit, not 16-bit, PCI 32-bit, 32 PCI. Sorry, there's the notation in the email is a little complicated. Yeah, yeah. So he's got two 32-bit PCI slots. He's got a 64-bit PCI slot with 100 megahertz video installed, a PCI Express 8X slot. It doesn't have a 16-bit slot on it. And he thinks the power supply is 1,500 watts, which is more than enough for most applications. I bought this from computergeeks.com for under $200 from Amazon. The item is sold out for a Xeon Quad 3.2 gigahertz processor. It has the stock video card, but only 32-bit XP drivers. No shock, because that's essentially a server you're running right there, or a workstation. I'm using Windows 7, 64-bit. It has 2 gigabytes of RAM, can handle 12 gigabytes max. So I need a card with GPU support for under $150, and I need help finding a gaming card for this system.
This is tough. Like, I guess a Dell PowerEdge SC1420 is basically a server.
Right.
I mean, it comes in the pictures I looked at least the ones I saw, comes in like a standard tower, but it's definitely a server hardware. Anything that has a PCIX slot on it is definitely server hardware. Unfortunately, it's PCIX, and that's where his graphics card is installed, which is odd. I don't know if I've ever seen that before. And the motherboard has PCI Express on it, but it's a x8 slot, not a x16 slot. You know, a lot of times you say, well, you've got a x16 slot. You can put a x16 card or x8 card. Even if it only runs at 8X electrically, you can install a x16 card in it. For whatever reason, maybe this is because it's an early implementation of PCI Express. Mm-hmm. They didn't do that on this motherboard. I was looking around at all kinds of different places, and your options for graphics cards are either the full x16, I don't have a graphics card sitting here, ironically, the full x16 slot or a x1 slot. I couldn't find anything that was in between. You know, you could find RAID cards in between at 4X and 8X. Graphics cards, you seem pretty limited between 16 or 1. And according to what I'm looking at here, mostly looking through Newegg, their highest performing PCI Express buy one graphics card is a Radeon HD 5450, which is not
it's
awful, but it's not. I mean, it's not a gaming graphics card.
Yeah, $140 for you know, sort of the mid price card of 2 years ago is just really painful. 5450, 4350, 4350. I almost want to say, if you really need a gaming card, you need to save your pennies up and buy a new motherboard.
And if you buy a new motherboard, I mean, you can get a motherboard that's going to work with those processors,
right?
And on all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, if you've got, what is it? It says it's a Xeon 3.2x4. I don't know if that's a quad core or a dual processor. Probably just a quad core processor. So it's a decently fast processor, by all accounts. And he says he's got Windows 7 Ultra 64-bit on there. It's only, he's got 2 gigs of memory on it. So, I mean, you could get a new motherboard and swap that out and go the gaming route that way, keeping your Xeon processor. Obviously, you know, he says he bought this for like $200, I think he said, like as a refurb product. For that kind of price, I mean, I would have bought that as well. It's a lot of hardware. But I probably wouldn't plan on using it as a gaming machine.
It would be an absolutely awesome workstation, an absolutely awesome video editing station if you didn't want to use GPU encoding. But it's interesting, right. Like nose around, I'm looking at some of the Xeon board options, and you're not really seeing a lot of 16-bit PCI Express. Yeah, it's really funny. I've just looked at like 3 different Xeon boards. And what's really crazy is like, you know, micro ATX Xeon boards, which is kind of an oxymoron. you know, true, I mean, it's true. Like, you know, I guess for, you know, rack mount systems. But yeah, again, 2 8X PCI Express 2.0 slots, 1 4X, 1 PCI slot. Man, this could be a tough one. I think you may be, I just don't think you're going to find a decent gaming card for that motherboard.
If anybody listening has insight into a Bi-8 physical slot, because the slot on this guy's motherboard doesn't extend to the full 16 length. It's only the 8 length, so he can't just install any graphics card in there. I'd like to see if there's any differences there or any other models that maybe I wasn't able to find while looking around. So, sorry, Joel, you are SOL until next week and somebody gives us an answer, or until you decide to upgrade your motherboard. We get another email here from Jim about triple and dual channel memory. It says he has an Intel DX58SO motherboard. That was, I think, the first high-end Intel, or the first Intel X58 motherboard to be released. And the manual says that installing memory in channel A, DIMM1, may result in less than optimal memory performance. It's an issue between dual channel memory operation and triple channel. Is this significantly different in performance? He says, which is mo better? 16 gigs with 4 DIMMs of dual channel, or 12 gigs with 3 DIMMs of triple channel memory? And if we show, I posted a picture of this motherboard so I can kind of clarify what this is. Mm-hmm. This motherboard was very odd. This is the first motherboard that came out with, or the first processor that came out with a triple channel memory controller.
Right.
The first motherboard that Intel made for it came with 4 DIMM slots.
Yeah, it's like 3 blue DIMM slots, 1 black yeah. DIMM slot, and hey, have fun with it, kids. We're not going to tell you too much about it.
Yeah, it seemed kind of weird, and I was always like, well, okay, it's triple channel. It seems to me like you either have 3 or you have 6, because you know you don't want to encourage people to do what this guy's asking. Do I want to put a 4th one in there and use 1 less memory channel and get the higher capacity? I'm trying to see what does he say he's doing there. He's got like Intel X25 160 gig SSDs. He's doing a lot of VMware stuff on here. I would say it's kind of a tough call, because it really depends on how much of that 12 gigs of memory you're actually using. Right. If you're doing a lot of virtual machines and you need that extra memory, then I think the performance benefit of 4 gigs extra memory will probably be pretty significant. If you find, however, that you're only really using, I don't know, even like 6 to 8 gigs of it, then I think the triple channel support might do better for the VMs, for being able to distribute the memory management across the extra channels. It doesn't really say a lot about what else he's doing. He says he's getting performance that's pretty good, although he doesn't say right. What implementation he has with the memory currently today.
At one point, the rule of thumb was, if you have, you know, 6 memory, if you have a choice between implementing your DDR3 across, you know, 2 sets of, like, you know, I've got 12 gigabytes spread across 6 DIMM slots. And, you know, at the time, getting 3 4 gigabyte DIMMs was prohibitively expensive. But there would be a performance boost going from, you know, 12 spread across 6 DIMM slots to 12 spread across 3 DIMM slots. But generally speaking, memory performance should be better on the 3 slots compared to the 4 slots. I mean, unless you absolutely positively need that last 4 gigabytes of memory, right?
Right, yeah. No, I think that's correct. So
we should also mention that Jim says, P.S., I'm a retired geek who started on vacuum tube machines, Bendix G15, and graduated to a PDP-5 and most everything thereafter. The i7-975 seems a lot faster than the G15 with its 100 kilohertz clock and rotating magnetic drum memory. That is nice. Officially old school.
No kidding.
Oh, my goodness. So hopefully that helps, Jim. Sean had a really good email about ARM-based Linux boxes. We were talking about that recently. Well, on last week's episode, you answered a listener's email about running an ARM-based torrent box. I would recommend he or she take a look at the Guru Plug line of devices available at globalscaletechnologies.com/c-4-guruplugs.aspx. They're 1.2 gigahertz ARM computers built into a tiny wall wart form factor. They're actually pretty cool. They sip less than 5 watts of electricity. They include gigabit Ethernet, Wi-Fi, internal flash storage, SD card slots, and USB ports for external storage. Some models even have eSATA and dual Ethernet ports. Prices start at $100. As for what OS to run, they come pre-installed with Debian Linux 5.0, Ubuntu, Gentoo, Arch, and several other flavors of Linux are available. And yes, Patrick, BSD too. FreeBSD and NetBSD are confirmed to be working, and it's likely there are others as well. I have a couple of these devices, and they are phenomenal. Thanks for the heads up, Sean.
Yeah, they're pretty cool looking little things. I've never used them. We got several emails in indicating that yes. Several versions of Linux will run on ARM development motherboards and that kind of stuff if you do happen to get them. But yeah, these little Guru plugs were kind of cool looking little devices, you know, that serve the purpose of if he's looking for a little tiny little box that you can connect an external hard drive to and run, you know, torrent software on it. You know, you don't need much to do that. My Marvel Armada 800 megahertz processor should get the job done.
I think plugcomputer.org might be the website for Marvell's. Just do a search. If you want to see something interesting, do a search for Plug Computer and see all the crazy stuff that comes up. Essentially, what would have been a pretty badass server 5 years ago fitting into a wall wart. Nice. Plugcomputer.org, or just do a search for Plug Computer. There's definitely some funny stuff coming up.
See, we got an email from Stefan about a question we had last week about a vision impairment, somebody who had a surgery done and had issues with his eyes. And I just thought it was cool to point out. It says, you're just listening to show 104, the gentleman with the acquired brain surgery and the affected vision in one eye. He wants to know where he lives because in many states here in America, there are wonderful programs with SSDI and or... he gave me a couple of URLs. I have worked with people that have qualified for benefits, minor vision issues. One thing to consider that I did not hear you discuss was the ambient light in the room. Sometimes putting a nightlight behind the monitor can ameliorate the contrast issue, i.e. bright screen versus relatively dark rest of room. Side lighting can also help or hurt. Having computer glasses might be as simple as tinting one eye or wearing a colored pair of glasses. SS, which is scotopic sensitivity syndrome. I guess I pronounced that right. That could only read for a few minutes unless he wore his blue tinted glasses. Not sure if SSS is a real thing, but he started finishing his homework and getting better grades in my class. There are a lot of cheap options that an expert in blindness, vision, brain injury that would go through this with him. Thus, the recommendation he hook up with the SSDI, NFB, or AARP. Hope this brings the guy some computing satisfaction. My advice, try all the $2 to free options first. Sometimes the simplest, cheapest things in the world can bring the greatest benefit. So I agreed. If we can,
thank you very much.
Remember to do that. We'll put some of those URLs in there for the SSA.gov and NFB.org are the two main things that he's listing here. So always good to hear.
Should we talk about Dave and the 30 inch monitor?
If you want to, it's going to make you hurt a little.
Oh, Dave emails, oh, Patrick, you missed it. I've been drooling over the U3011 to accompany my 3008 WFP. These are Dell monitors, 30-inch Dell monitors. By chance, I visited the Dell outlet a week before Christmas, and they were actually on the front page as new additions for $899. To put that in perspective, that's a $1,500 monitor normally. Oof. For under $900. I quickly proceeded to place an order to see if it was actually in stock, and to my surprise, it still allowed me to proceed to checkout. Then I had a dilemma. Should I actually buy it instead of wishing about it? Before my brain could think of what the finance committee would say, my twitchy mouse finger accidentally pulled the trigger on the purchase button and accidentally again on the confirm order button. Yeah, I bet the financial committee loved that excuse.
I hate when that happens.
Darn those sticky mouse buttons that arrived just after Christmas and works as well as looks fabulous. Nothing like Lightroom 3 with all this dual screen real estate. 30 inches. Dude's got two 30-inch monitors. I'm jealous.
So I just went to go look just now, just in case we were giving away all the secrets to the chat room and stuff, and there are none of those on there. So,
yeah, I checked before I added that question to the list. They don't even have any ultra sharp monitor stuff in stock.
Man. No, they did. I do see an Alienware 3D monitor up there as a refurb, which is interesting. But all right, so I guess the secret is here. Check constantly to that website, and Patrick, check more constantly than everybody else.
Yeah, apparently I need to check it every night before I go to sleep. Hey, should we answer Daniel's question about remote controlling?
Well, we can ask it. I don't know if we'll be able to answer it. I don't know.
I believe I have an answer for it.
Good. Let's do this then.
Let's do this thing. Do you want to read it, or should I read it? Or
I'll take it. He says he has an office in the back of his house where he's located a full-size vertical case water-cooled computer he built a couple of years ago. In his living room at the front of the house, he has a Panasonic TCP58 VT25 with, I don't know, I guess that's the TV, Panasonic DMP-B Blu-ray player, TiVo Premiere, WD Live, and assorted Sunfire audio products. He's connected them all to his router in his office via an Ethernet cable strung under the house and connected to a four port switch in the living room. As an aside, I find it funny that I have to have four Ethernet cables strung in my living room equipment to fully hook it up. And Netflix is everywhere. Here's his issue, though. His goal initially was to also make the computer a remote DVR. Now with four-channel DVR cards available, and unfortunately, the rather slow performance of the TiVo Premiere, I want to implement this even more. But how can I remotely control the DVR card and the computer in my office with a remote that I have in my hand in the living room? Any ideas?
Robert Herron, my co-host on TechZilla and HD Nation, is a massive, dedicated, serious, hardcore Windows Media Center geek who's got the four-channel cards running. We did he's basically running a four-channel. He can record four channels simultaneously over cable guard. And we've done some segments on that on TechZilla. And just last week, he walked through Remote Potato, which is a really inexpensive application that allows remote administration of Windows Media Center. Actually, like, you can do it over an iPhone or an iPad. And there are a few applications that are similar to that out there. But I think Remote Potato would be one that's worth checking out because you can do some pretty good scheduling and control of your Windows Media Center. Basically, like, pick the television shows you want to record or remotely stream stuff to your phone. It's pretty painless. I'm trying to think of what the last update
Remote Potato. I just like the name. I don't know about the product yet, but
Heron's pretty excited about it. It makes him pretty happy. Fat Attitude Limited Remote is the company that makes it.
Okay.
They call it the missing part of Windows 7 Media Center. If you can remotely access your PC over the internet, if you have an internet connection, you should have no problems remotely doing that. Basically web browser or on the iOS on any iPad, iPhone, iPod Touch, or anything with a browser, you can use to remotely control the recording features on your Windows Media Center system. So I would highly recommend checking that out.
Very cool. Before we round out the show this week, I figure I have some more stuff in the office that I feel like giving away. So we're going to have another contest. We just now finally shipped out the stuff from episode 100. Took a lot longer than I thought. A lot of it was waiting for email addresses and stuff to come back. But here's what we're going to give away today. This is a fully functional Intel motherboard, mind you, for the previous generation of product. This is the Intel DP55WG Media Series motherboard, completely brand new. It's actually still sealed. It still has a sticker on it. Apparently, I never opened it.
So you assume it works.
I assume it works. P55 motherboard. It's for the Linfield processors, LGA 1156 processor sockets, 4 DDR3 slots, PCI Express by 16 graphics. So if our listener who sent in the question with the server motherboard wins this, he can build a gaming rig based on it. 6 fully functional SATA 3.0 gigabit per second ports. I just felt the need to point that out. it does do SLI graphics as well as Crossfire graphics. Nice. So if you need an upgrade for your system, I guess it kind of fills the whole screen here, doesn't it? then you can win this from This Week in Computer Hardware. Now, how do you win this? It's very easy. Send an email to twitch@twit.tv. Subject line has to be contest. It's very important. Otherwise, it won't get filtered to the right place. All right. And this time, what I'm going to have everybody do is pre-input their name, address, and phone number. That way, if you win, I can ship it out immediately next week. Boom, nice. We don't have to worry about going back and forth and all that kind of stuff. So what you need to include in the email, besides your name, address, phone number, is it has the Techzilla posted yet, and with which I am a guest host.
It is. It went up today.
It is. Okay. Okay, good. So in that, we want the URL of the Techzilla episode in which I talk with Patrick about the Intel chipset issue, and the URL to any news post from PCPer.com where we discuss the Intel recall. So if you put those two URLs in there, then you will be entered into the contest to win a non-recalled chipset motherboard from Intel. So how's that?
That's awesome, dude. I'd also like to point out we have a really good Alex Lindsay comes on. You guys may know him from MacBreak on this week's TechZilla, the one that just posted, and talks about shooting 3D video. You can buy 3D camcorders for as little as $400 now, but shooting them is a little different. And Veronica has her first look hands-on review of the Dell Streak, which I think Wired.com was obnoxiously harsh on. Do you ever read one of those reviews, Ryan, and you're just like, wow, that was just mean?
Yeah, we get a lot of those, unfortunately. That looks cool, though. So you've got your hands on it now, though, so you've been playing with it as well.
Yeah, just a little bit. Veronica's actually going to do some long-term testing with it over the next week or two. I also, like, something we didn't talk about is Honeycomb came out this week. The big sort of announcement for Android 3.0, which is pretty much for tablets only. It's not really a phone operating system. So it's been interesting to watch people react to that. I think it's going to be interesting to see how long it's going to take to filter down on devices. Unfortunately, I let the battery run out because I wasn't paying attention. But I do like the Tegra 2 processor. But I'm hearing rumors that you can really blow through the battery on a lot of the Tegra 2 devices if you are not cautious with
what
you're doing.
That's not good news. That is not good news.
Yeah.
Now, somebody, the chat room is telling me that they didn't hear the contest rules. So let me repeat that again. Email, twitch@twit.tv, contest subject line, name, address, phone number. First, you have to include two URLs. First one, the URL to the Techzilla episode. You can go to techzilla.com and find all that, where I discuss with Patrick the Intel 6 Series chipset recall, and then any URL from PC Perspective where we discuss the Intel 6 Series chipset recall, and you could win the Intel DP55WG working, completely functional, non-recalled chipset motherboard.
Non-recalled chipset motherboard. Thanks, dude. That's an awesome contest.
You got to specify these dates. So
outside of compatible motherboards, do we have a guide coming up in PC Per what you can buy while you're waiting for Sandy Bridge to come back? Is that coming up in the next few days?
There's something like that coming up. We are going to discuss, kind of editorialize, what do you do for the next 4 to 6 weeks. It could be options of go with AMD. Maybe this is the time to invest in your graphics card or an SSD rather than upgrade your processor anyway. Something like that. We're definitely working on that kind of stuff. We still have more graphics card releases coming out in the not too distant future. Some new Corsair speakers. Those reviews are going to go up, if not tomorrow, early next week as well.
There's a very nice TI roundup, by the way, if you're thinking about spending $250 for a GPU up on PCPer.com, because NVIDIA just, you watch the show, you know this is happening, but it's nice because I'm actually like, oh, I'm ready to buy a new graphics card.
Yes.
And I'm glad I waited 2 weeks.
Good timing. Yeah.
Yeah. I got lucky for a change. At Ryan Shrout is where you can tweet Ryan. At Patrick Norton is where you can find me. PCPer.com is the home of Ryan's work. You can find me at revision3.com/Techzilla or Techzilla with a K.com. I got to say, I think that's it for this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. Thanks, everybody, for watching. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week.